prospects for measuring everything.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for having me. So really sorry to introduce, I'm Chad Hanna. So I'm going to kind of give a somewhat broad talk, maybe with some stuff at the end, maybe with some ideas in people's head. But I'm going to specifically talk about searches for compact binary coalescence. So those of you who saw Patrick Brady's colloquium yesterday got a reasonable overview of sort of LIGO stuff in general. He ended up focusing a bit on, in the end, binaries. But there'll be a bit more probably here. If anyone has any questions throughout any of the talk, please stop. Happy to take questions. Okay. So, like Lee says, I'm really more involved. I'm really more involved with the data. I consider myself a data analyst. Specifically, we're doing gravitational wave searches, and we're using these laser interferometers. This is one of the LIGO sites here. Okay, so I think most of you are familiar with gravitational waves, how it works. So I say I'm a data analyst. Loosely, that's detecting and hopefully measuring parameters of gravitational wave signals. At some point, you know, we like to do it, we'll call it astronomy. But so far, we don't actually have any signals. But we're trying to get things sorted out. So specifically, the way we do it is with these laser interferometer devices. The idea is that a passing gravitational wave changes the distance in the orthogonal arms of one of these interferometers, and you would get you'd be able to measure the signal just from the sort of interfering light patterns. What actually happens is those mirrors don't move. Of course, it's actually a complicated control system that keeps things locked. And you have to measure the air signal required to keep everything locked. And some of that, we hope, will come from gravitational waves. Okay, so I think since LIGO really was sort of started, one of the more promising sources was the merger of two compact objects. So specifically, black hole binaries, binary neutron stars, or a combination of either one. These things are sufficiently small. So what happens is, you know, Poincaré theory predicts they're going to radiate energy. They're going to get closer orbits. As they get closer, and they radiate more, and that makes the amplitude higher, which makes them go closer even faster. And what you'd end up with is that if you were to measure the strain from this, you'd see things that increase in both amplitude and frequency. And so here's an example of the waveform here. This bit intentionally cuts off early. So here, it doesn't actually, you don't actually see these two things go together. It sort of stops at some radius. That's because for a while, what we realized was that since these things have a characteristic frequency, it's really mostly this in-spiral bit that's in the band that we can detect for low-mass systems. And I say low-mass meaning things like neutron star size. And so for a long time, and even now, we actually can get away with just sort of this in-spiral description for the purposes of doing data analysis, for actually finding these signals. If you want to go to something with more mass overall, then actually what happens is the characteristic frequency which these things happen gets lower. And it turns out that what happens beyond the part where these things are separated, when they get very close together, they begin to merge, and they've actually coalesced, that stuff becomes important. And for that, we actually need, or we needed help from numerical relativity to solve the waveform that extends beyond the in-spiral in this blue and adds to the end what the signal looks like from the merger. And actually, if it forms a black hole in the end, the black hole is perturbed, and it actually brings down and radiates energy in this damp sinusoid kind of thing with color right now. So I'll discuss how we're actually finally getting around to, in data analysis, using what we've learned from numerical relativity. Okay, so then the third part really is what do we do next? What does the future hold? What's the 10-year plan kind of thing? And so that's going to be kind of open-ended, and maybe by the end we can talk about some of that. Okay. So this is the outline, basically. I'm going to discuss the immediate goals of the LVC collaboration, LIGO, Virgo. These are the LIGO detectors are in the States. Virgo is an Italian-French project in Europe that we have now joined with. They have a similar detector there. I'm going to decide where we are, what we've published so far, also kind of what we can do right now with what we've just got. So basically things you'll expect to see in a couple of years coming out of the collaboration. This includes, of course, using numerical relativity results. And then at the end, I want to talk a little bit about advanced detectors and what's going to happen 10 years down the road. What do we expect to find, what we can do with it? The immediate goal part. So I think Patrick said all these identical words yesterday. The immediate goal is to detect gravitational radiation. So for those of you who don't know, we haven't done it directly. There are indirect evidence, lots of indirect evidence from binary pulsar systems. They seem to emit gravitational radiation because they're starting to inspiral at the rate you predict. These sources, one of the questions that people often ask as soon as they hear this, well, why can't we detect those sources if we know they exist? They have too low frequency, unfortunately. The binary pulsars that have been observed actually still have orbital periods of, I think, at least hours, something like that. And what that corresponds to is a gravitational wave frequency that's actually out of the band of the ground-based detectors. So we know these things exist, but they're kind of sitting there just taunting us in some sense. But the fact that these things exist, and we can postulate that maybe other things involving black holes exist, too, that are compact. It's not too much of a jump to say, well, we know these things exist at other certain separations. Somewhere in the universe, hopefully, there are some that are a lot closer, and that are now have evolved so far that they're actually maybe getting ready to merge. And so that's the game we're trying to play. We hope that those things are out there. These things are predicted based on these observations and also, you know, complicated population synthesis models and stuff that people do with binary evolution and things like this. We expect these things to exist just as a consequence of binary stellar evolution. The other source that these heavier things may be actually more exotic, I don't know, the term intermediate mass black hole, maybe not quite what people used to say in these mass ranges. But the point is that we are sensitive to sort of black hole sizes that you wouldn't expect from stellar evolution necessarily. So if there's some formation scenario that would make these systems, then perhaps we can detect this. But the bottom line, and the emphasis I want to give in this talk, is that the compact binary coalescence is actually really one of our best sources, and in some sense it's the one that we're really counting on. So I've told you that we haven't actually measured any signals, but that doesn't mean that we can't do some science with what we've got so far and continue to do a bit of science, so long as that's true. We can constrain the merger rates directly on these systems by not observing them, basically. And at some point, as we get more observation time and our detectors become more sensitive, the constraint will actually be astrophysically meaningful. And constraining the existence of binaries in general or of specific classes of binaries by not observing them can actually help tune some of these parameters and models people have for how binary systems evolve, basically. We can also, and we know this because we've actually done it, which is nice, it is possible to provide information about some of the EM events that happen. So, there's a GRB, 470201, that actually had an air box exposition that overlapped with Andromeda, and LIGO was actually able to exclude that it was a binary coalescence in Andromeda. Okay. Constraining the merger rates. Basically, what we set out to do with the data we have when we do a search and we don't find something is we just at least publish what we call an upper limit on the rate, and it's just a 90% confidence upper bound on how often we think these things will happen. We tend to do this as a function of mass. It used to be that in the literature, you would see rates quoted as mergers per year per Milky Way equivalent galaxies. So that's probably something that needs a little explanation. So we know that these binary clusters, of course, exist in our galaxy. We expect them to exist in galaxies like ours. And in some sense, the number of galaxies that your detector is sensitive to, it's sort of the natural unit for figuring out how many of these things you'd expect to observe in an amount of time. We actually do normalization. It's a bit different now. So if you've read the literature, just to give some explanation, we've dropped the Milky Way equivalent galaxy and unit and instead taken units of 10 to the 10 solar luminosities and blue light. The idea is that binary formation under should be a portion of the blue light if you assume sort of constant, or assuming constant binary formation. So you'd expect the number of these things in a galaxy to be proportional to that. It's probably not actually a great approximation because there are some subtleties that mean it's probably not the best thing. But it's what we've done. In the end, it sort of doesn't matter. The blue light has a function of distance from our detector. In the beginning, there's sort of these discrete steps and features and excess. And if you want to constrain locally what's going on, you need to count galaxies to understand how many sources you might observe. But actually, in the sort of advanced detector era, and even where we're heading now, it's basically the assumption that everything is uniform and well-behaved, or can be described that way, is sensible. And it also asymptotes to basically what you have to account for is the volume of space that you're observing. I bring this up because I think you'll sort of see in future papers moving to these simpler units, hopefully, which are just something like mergers per year per megaparsec cubed.
So here, so in that plot,
yes,
how far data for? There is a lot of that is wishful thinking, right? Or
well, no, this is megaparsecs down here. Currently, our range puts us, so this bump, I believe, is about the Virgo cluster, roughly.
Okay, and you extrapolate from there.
Yeah, and after that, the galaxy catalogs aren't complete, but they're really starting to get uniform, so it doesn't matter. And at that point, we just assume extrapolation. Our current set sensitivity, realistically, is a volume that puts us about the Virgo cluster. But, you know, it's the advanced detectors are going to get us out here. We'll talk about that later. So the take-home message is that the number of sources we hope to observe is going to go up cubically with our distance that we can make the detector more sensitive. So if we make the detector more sensitive by a factor of 10, we would expect 1,000 times more sources based on galaxy counts or just volume or whatever you want. Okay. So I think these are the most recent published upper limits. I think the one that Patrick showed the other day were actually not most recent ones. These have included about 18 months of science run at our Design Institute. So LIGO has run for about 2 years between 2005 and 2007 at its design sensitivity, and we were able to search for binaries during this time and basically place these sorts of constraints on rate. It is a function of mass, and heavier systems radiate more, we can see further. Some of these are done with total masses of binary. Some of these are assuming that the companion is a neutron star, and then comparing this the solar mass of this object is seems to be a black hole. These rates are still quite a ways from astrophysical predictions, but they're actually getting better. And increased observation time and more sensitive detectors will just keep beating them down lower. We're actually currently running with a detector that's probably 40 or 50% improved over our S5 run. So you could imagine numbers like this getting better than a factor of 2 lower because we'll have more sensitivity. So maybe a factor of a few lower in the coming years.
So just 2 questions. The first one is the reason behind stating with 90% confidence is because of the template you're using and things of that sort, or is anything else?
No, it's just a statistical statement integrating we use this procedure that allows us to event upper limit, which is basically say, well, we didn't detect anything, and but our search still identified candidates. And if you assume that then that the rate you is consistent with the rate you observe is like zero in your sensitivity volume, and you assume like Poisson statistics and you integrate that out 90%. This is what you get.
Okay, and the second one is so the way rate this plot is so if I take a total mass of say 25, then it go up, I see roughly 10^-3 without systematic error and slightly larger. Yeah, so why do you have a blackish region of
This is not supposed to see this here.
Yeah.
This is just the excluded region. I'm not sure why they make the plots like this. To be honest, I don't like them so much. But this is the ones that the collaboration settled on. This is basically taken to be an excluded region.
Okay.
So we know that the rate here is no higher than this region, 90% confidence. Thank you, though. Thank you for making that clear.
Yeah, cool thing. So Alpena can still think of this as being one galaxy.
Basically, yeah. It's at 1.7. L10s of the Milky Way. So.
Okay.
And the reason for doing that, just to make it clear, was to remove the Milky Way's intrinsic uncertainty. Being inside the Milky Way makes it hard to pin down its own luminosity. So removing that from the mix is just...
And then, so when you're in the upper range of total mass, you know, around 20 to 25, so now the ring down starts becoming a significant portion of your... So what kind of templates are you using to do this?
Good question. So... At this point, yeah, the merger, the ring down, that's exactly right. It's starting to become extremely important. This search did not use templates that included those effects, but we have changed that, and I'm actually going to get to that. That's actually what I work on, is searches that include templates with the full description. So that's a good question. So basically, what Eric was asking was, you know, originally we showed this plot of the InSPAR waveform, and it does this trip signal. It gets increased in amplitude, increased in frequency, and up until very recently, we didn't have, you know, numerical relativity to give us a lot of information about what merger looked like. We had ring down from theory for a long time, but there was some stuff missing sort of in between that we wanted. So what we did was we said, well, for the low masses, it kind of doesn't matter. We just get the InSPAR part right, we'll search for that. But once you what he points out is once you get up here, it actually starts to matter. So. Okay, and then this one is, you know, this one's kind of exciting. It's just because it feels like astrophysics a little bit, at least. You have to take what you can get. So this was this GRB 070201. That means it happened year 2007, February 1st. So it turns out this was right smack in the middle of one of our science run that was a design sensitivity. We had, I believe, two detectors running. They were the co-located detectors. That might not be correct. I think that was the case, though. The co-located detectors in Hanford, Washington. The idea is that this gamma ray burst went off, and its air box in position overlapped Andromeda's far. And so, if it is, again, a standard gamma ray burst, and the model one of the models that people suggest could be for these things is that they're merging neutron star binaries or neutron star black hole binaries. So if that's the case, well, we should measure gravitational waves from it because that's awfully close. Even with the detectors that we have, you know, Andromeda is less than a megaparsec. I think it's 760 kiloparsecs, and so that's very, very close. So even with our parent detectors, which are not, you know, these advanced error detectors, this would be a pretty good signal. And so what that means is, A, we could have measured something. We could have gotten lucky. We didn't. But we can say then we can actually exclude that this was a binary merger. And so that exclusion across the mass range of possible neutron star pairs or neutron star stellar mass black hole pairs, and by stellar mass I really mean all the way up to something pretty big, like in the 30s, we can exclude those being the cause of this. 99%. So that's pretty cool. It's actually better than
99%. How can you do it to 99% again? Because here, aren't you using the template?
Yeah, but even taking into account all the systematic errors, the point is that we would have measured such a loud signal even if you were wrong in the templates.
Okay.
It doesn't happen. And that all is folded into a statement like this. You know, the error bars up in the previous plot where they're marginalizing our systematic errors, things like our inability to know the waveform, we estimate that as well as we can at all this. So this is then to the question that Eric asked about going beyond the eight-spiral phase. Okay, so everything previously that I've just shown you was just the in-spiral phase. It did not take into account effects that were the merger phase of the in-spiral or the ring-down phase. So that the stuff that we didn't have a full description of end-to-end until somewhat recently for a lot of parameters. For low-mass systems, this doesn't really matter because all of that stuff, the merger and the ring-down, happened at high frequencies. Detectors aren't sensitive there. But the point is that some characteristic frequency, and I just picked one, the last stable orbit, the ISCO, whatever you'd like to call it, 6M. I picked that as just a characteristic frequency for these things. And the point is in units of hertz, which are the ones we like to look at, it's going to scale like 4,400 hertz times times the inverse mass and solar mass. So if you have 100 solar mass object total, then 44 hertz is going to be a characteristic very low. But the point is that something that's 44 solar masses, 100 hertz starts to matter. So these effects with merger and ring down and stuff are going to start to matter. And so we actually have to take into account what's going on there. I'll confess, for those of you out there thinking, searching for these systems probably less bounded than searching for stellar mass systems. People actually have done rates on them. We think that if they do exist, they're lower. At some point, you get to such a high mass that you don't expect it to be made from stellar evolution, at least not in this universe. So you often need more exotic situations to form them. They have to be products of other mergers, something like that. Now, some people call that a long shot. Of course, long shot also have a payoff. So if you do directly measure these systems, it does say something really cool about astrophysics that we probably don't even know yet, so it's kind of fun. Okay. So here's some gritty detail. These are the sorts of plots I get to look at all day. All right, so here's some actual spectra. Now, I was making these arguments about frequencies and how they scale with mass. Currently, one of the searches I'm working on is a search that actually looks for mass range of 25 to 100 solar masses. This is supposed to be MO dot, but the conversion of PowerPoint was. I don't know what this is. Anyway, 199, or 1 to 99 component masses, but total mass of 25 to 100. So at this point, the really all three phases are important to get right. And so for this, you actually really like to have a description of the waveform that goes the whole way through. Fortunately, numerical relativity has delivered on this recently. And what they've done is provided lots of points in the parameter space of black hole mergers. Nothing with very asymmetric mass ratios or anything like that, but it's been good enough that people have tried to model it, made some sort of analytic adjustments to models. One of such things are these EOB waveforms, where they've been tuned to numerical relativity. This is an example of one of them. You can see that, I think this is also the 30-30 that's here, but I might be wrong. The LIGO spectrum that I've been talking about, which is our noise curve, this is the amplitude spectral density here. And these are arbitrary units. They were just renormalized to make them all fit on one plot. But what's important is the shape. So the point is that at low frequencies, this is down to 40 hertz, I think. At low frequencies, sensitivity is much lower than at 150 hertz. And then it turns around again up here. So really, where you can get most of your signal-to-noise ratio when you're detecting binaries, or anything for that matter, with LIGO, is here. I've even normalized. So it turns out that one of these systems that are kind of heavier, the entire phase of in-spiral, which is described by this f to the minus 7/6 power law approximately, some merger effects, and then the sort of ring down, which decays exponentially, they tend to be all right in this band. So it's going to be important.
What was the green curve?
The green curve is this. So this is the raw waveform. Thank you, Russ. The green curve is the raw waveform. The red curve is the raw waveform. The green curve is the waveform combined with the spectrum. So the actually optimal filter actually carries the power of the Kelvin spectrum.
So it's basically over SM.
That's right. Over square root SM, actually.
Square root, yeah.
Okay. Now, these systems, you know, they're more of a long shot. But the cool thing is if they do exist, we can see them really far away, even with the current detectors. The heavier, they radiate more. That's basically the bottom line. Currently, if you look at sort of the effective distance is actually, think of this as the maximum distance that we could ever observe one of these, assuming all the conditions were just right, meaning that it was just over top of our detectors, and it was pointing right at us. So the maximum we would expect to see these lower mass guys, this curve continues down from neutron stars, with current detectors is maybe 50 megaparsecs. As you increase the mass, it goes up and up and up. If you didn't include the merger and ring down in your search, it would turn over pretty fast. If you actually can model the merger and ring down properly, this curve grows considerably. This is a linear scale to make it so dramatic. The range is actually considerably higher. Currently, we're stopping our search at 100 solar masses for some technical reasons. We will go higher, and actually, another group is addressing this area too. But even at the edge of this mass space that we're now searching, you can see you've gotten a limit range, an equivalent range. So if there's something out there, it's a great source.
And that thing again, the blue line turns around again, because
yes.
If you keep increasing the mass, then it goes off to the
side. That's right. At some point, they're too heavy to observe the frequencies. The ring down frequency is too low.
So does that mean, so you're going, that's the current detector plot?
Yeah.
So you could be seeing 700 megaparsecs in your data.
Yeah. Now, the huge caveat here, actually took this slide out, which is a terrible thing to have done. The huge caveat is this assumes some fiducial signal-to-noise ratio. Now, in the end, our detector data is not very well behaved. So what you have to weigh this against is probability of getting a false alarm at some particular SNR. And so and at the end of the day, the range might not be quite that good. I happen to know it's still pretty good. So
at what point, you say going above 100 solar masses, at what point does that just become a burst search?
Yes, that's a great question. About there. Which there were technical reasons why we didn't extend it further, and honestly, that's exactly what happens. At that point, the waveform, you can imagine this waveform's already getting kind of short, and by in band, this is a waveform that's in the LIGO band. Of course, these things exist for a long time previously as they're coming together. But the important part is the stuff that gets into the spectrum region, you know, where I have on the previous plot. As you're increasing the mass, you're basically excluding early the in-spiral phase more and more and more. And at some point, you're sensitive to this bit, which is the short duration. And so these burst searches are things that are really just targeted for searching for sort of very short, blippy things in the data. They have different techniques. Actually, they work very well for the situation. Okay, so here's actual simulations. The previous one was just a prediction. What we did is we took a bunch of these IMR waveforms. We use the UVMR model. We also use this other one, which we sort of colloquially call the phenomenological model. It was something produced by a group at AEI and Vienna, and I'm not sure where else. They're spread around at this point, I think. But another parameterization of numerical relativity into some waveform. We've injected whatever we've got, basically. And this plot is a plot we typically make, which shows we put the waveforms into the data, and we try to pick them with the right ones, and we say, did we find them or not? The black are things we didn't find. The green are things that we found with two detectors, and the blue are the things we found with all three detectors. Our detectors have slightly different sensitivities, so you actually expect some sort of transition region here where the one detector is not going to be able to see the signal with the other two. The point of this, the take-home message is, this is actually now in units of trip mass, but for symmetric systems, it's an easy scaling. The point is now that we actually have sensitivity to about that 700-ish mark that we were hoping for. Okay, but what we need, so this isn't the end from numerical relativity. These waveforms are still, don't take into account the spin of the individual components. That's going to be a big effect here. It's likely to be a big effect. Although we're probing very asymmetric mass ratios, it's been done by an analytic extension. I know asymmetric mass ratios are extremely difficult to do with numerical relativity, but it doesn't mean that I wouldn't ask if I had everything that I could get. But it would be nice to verify that some of the analytic extensions into that region make sense. Also, the big one, and maybe this one's longer term, but the big ones matter. If one of these components is, in fact, a neutron star, there may be matter effects that, A, could affect detection, but even if not, will have possibly measurable physics that we have to develop. Okay, so what about the next decade? 5 or 6 years, advanced detectors will come on. They will be sensitivity 10 times in range, better than they are now. That's going to mean 1,000 times more sources. So we can do science without detections, but let's face it, we stand more to learn from what we can detect than what we cannot. So I'm hoping for these. There are tons of speculative sources. Frankly, the thing that I want to drive home to people, it's really the binaries that I think are the ones that are likely, not just possible. So I think likely, I think the binary is like, I think to quote Patrick on this yesterday, he calls it the bread and butter, and that is really the case. And so what we want to maybe focus efforts on, if we're going to try to get some physics out of gravitational wave astronomy in the next 10 years, is how to work with the binaries. Well, this sets up the scenario. So just, you're probably asking, well, what's likely? What does this mean? 40 events per year. I actually have a reference here. Someone asked Patrick this too, and he gave an answer that was good. He said, this number doesn't seem to have changed much in the last few years, so we're really thinking 40 is about right. This is most likely, so this is mean on a bigger distribution, right? It could be higher, it could be lower. The 95% confidence interval, if I remember correctly, is something like 4 to 400, so it's about smack in the middle of an order of magnitude.
What makes 8 a magic number?
8 is a magic number because that's sort of what we believe we'll be able to detect at. If it were Gaussian noise, 8 would be no problem. With real detectors, it's challenging, but we think we can do it. Does that make sense? You expect just false alarms from Gaussian noise, period, at some point. You measure signal-to-noise ratio two events all the time, just from noise. Hmm. And the question is, what's the probability of getting one of these things from the kind of noise you have? So you have to take that into account before you put these. Okay, so the trick is here, 40 events above SNR8, the probability of getting an SNR above some value is inversely proportional to SNR squared because the SNR falls off like range and the signals go up like volume. So if we get 32 events above SNR8, close to 40. We'd only expect 4 above 16 and probably nothing less than 30. So it's going to be a challenging endeavor to extract stuff from here, but that's not to sound pessimistic. That's actually to turn it around the other way a bit, because it means we actually have to do some work to figure out what we can get out of it and where we should focus. One of the things that can be done in advanced detector era, which is non-trivial, so you have to make a good case for it, is to actually change the tuning of the detector. If we believe that interesting physics happens at high frequencies because, well, neutron star equation of state starts to, you know, the radius of the neutron star starts to affect the waveform, and maybe we can probe that. Or magnetic fields, I think some people here are interested in that, changing the waveform. Alternative views of gravity. I don't know anything about that, but if there's something to be learned there, maybe that's where you'd measure it. If there are these high-frequency effects that have to be taken into account, it's good to know those things now to get estimates on them. It is possible that even though our standard detector configuration for advanced LIGO is something kind of broadband, there is a possibility with this yellow curve to do a narrowband tuning that can tailor to some higher frequency. The problem is, of course, at the expense of detecting the bread and butter that you're going to really see here. So you want to be worried about this. And it's a non-trivial thing at this point to do. It actually involves changing a mirror. So it's not something you can do in a day.
How does that deeper part in the with the yellow line translate into distance between the red one and the orange one? And do you gain a lot?
Well, so being able to measure it at this frequency would be go up by a factor, would go down by a factor of 4. So you have in that band 4 times the signal to noise ratio. Now that's not to be taken as 4 times the signal to noise ratio overall, of course. That would just be a win for everything. But if the effect you're trying to measure is isolated to these frequencies, you can do better.
Do you have to go in and change the color optics?
The recycling mirror. Yeah. So it's not as bad. No, otherwise it would be hopeless.
Yeah.
But the recycling mirror, which is, if someone wants more detail, I can go into that maybe after that. But. So I'll come to the end. So it's actually hopeful, but it's hard. And we're going to have limited observation with modest signals, probably. In fact, it's likely. It's something I think you can count on. That we're going to find these things in advanced LIGO detector era. But we're going to really need to know where to look if we want to make that second year of observation after we've measured our first 40 and everyone's happy and we've had our champagne. After that, if we want to do something a little different with the second year because we can, then let's figure out what that is. People interested in neutron star physics have been thinking about this, and I just want to use this as an example, not like it's the only thing that can be done. Neutron star equations of state. The idea is that it modifies this chirp waveform at some point. Now it happens at high frequency. It's going to be important for neutron star and neutron star black holes. The fact that this is a kilohertz and the fact that graph previously was tuned to a kilohertz is not necessarily a complete coincidence. So the idea is that the spectra of these waveforms that you'd expect is this nice clean thing. These are numerical relativity or numerical simulations, so they're a bit fuzzy, but neglecting this sort of maybe eccentricity or something, this noise here, I don't know what this is, but the point is it deviates from what you'd expect substantially at different stages and in different ways, depending on what your equation state model is away from. And that's the take-home message here. There are things that can be learned if you can understand how you want to affect the waveforms. So this is the challenge. What can we learn other than, hey, we just found gravitational waves? What do we need to do to plan to maximize that knowledge? That's all I've got. Thanks. There are 7 minutes.
Pretty good time. Questions? So what are some of the systematic errors?
In general?
Yeah.
So what you're asking about is, because you can answer that question a couple of ways. Let's talk about those ones, because I'm guessing that's what you're directly asking about. So several things, actually. The imprecise knowledge of waveforms, which we try to model by many different ways, the sort of post-Newtonian kind of expansions are to different orders. You can inject a bunch of different orders or a bunch of different families of these things. I mean, people arrive at these things with different resummation techniques and all sorts of wiggle room to get slightly different waveforms out. Basically, we can sort of inject all of those things in, use a single family to detect them, and get an idea for how bad we're doing just by brute force sort of checking these things. Actually, some of the biggest systematic errors in here, sadly, is our ability to know the luminosity and distances of galaxies. It's a 20-30% effect. It's kind of irrelevant because in the cubic age, what really matters is our ability to know the blue light density, which is a little bit better. It's 20%. There are Monte Carlo errors. These things, when you want to really test them and do them right, if you run them end-to-end through a pipeline, and these things are all quite computationally costly. And so you would like to simulate till you're blue in the face, but there's a limit that you can do it, and finish in a reasonable time at a reasonable cost. And so there are Monte Carlo errors. If your parameter space is big, if you're trying to measure, you know, how well can you do with spin, et cetera, those give big effects.
That's all on the theory side. When you've got the
errors of the detector, good point. Calibration is another big one. Actually, it's lower than all the other ones now, which is why it's so far in my mind, thank goodness.
Is it?
Yeah.
Including S6?
Well,
okay.
S6 is new. But up until S6, yeah, S6 is a little bit rough, but there is calibration errors on how well we can basically turn whatever the detector does into the strain. That's a non-trivial process, and there are errors in that. But right now, they're actually lower than these other errors. But at some point, we want this to be the limiting errors. Get everything else sorted out. Anything else?
So since ruling out the binary constants as the source of the cause of the GRB and the meta, what do people think it is now?
Oh, good question. Well, I'm not sure if this is, so there were different things, but basically I think it's, another thing is just, it's not well known, but isolated neutron stars sometimes have just random chaotic events that emit gamma rays. There are certainly these short, these gamma ray bursts, soft gamma ray bursts, that's right, so, and maybe it's just something like that. I mean, also, you know, that's what people think it is, because astronomers are following this up, they know what they're doing. From the, the gamma ray burst side, but also the fact that the airbox overlapped. I mean, it could have been a compact binary, 200 megaparsecs behind. People don't think that.
So the stuff you were saying about the neutron star equation of state,
yes,
that we could determine this. Is this, like, you think I could determine mu? And is it going to be something that we don't already see from M&M, like a soft gamma ray burst or something else? What are you trying?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the idea is that there is enough wiggle room in the equations to state for these things that would determine basically just simple things like radius, how big they are. And the way to measure that is it's going to be interacting with another neutron star, a black hole. You're going to get a sense for the sort of geometry in there. I think that's the idea.
Yeah, the cool thing there is that you start seeing effects when the stars are still rather cold. Nothing's going on. So you get something from this gamma ray burst, but then there is a lot of time waving there that goes into the model. And if everything takes place, then you can from there infer something, but then you have to buy on all this. Well, this
so this is a Kainer, okay, Kainer signal.
It's good. Well, as long as you believe in GR.
This all presupposes that.
That's all you need to buy. Okay.
If you want to propose other things to test, that's.
Well, yeah, so that was the question. So you're in the trenches, you know what the dynamics is inside. So at what point, and what would it take for LIGO to come out and say GR is wrong?
Why are you asking me a question?
I want to know how much I can procrastinate within GR without having to worry about anything else.
I don't even do quite a ways, probably. I mean, there are things that would that if they're going to be really big effects, they're going to be really big effects. But probably if you're talking about things that are going to happen late in the stage of things when they're really close and really, really fast, that's going to be hard in general to measure. Even if it's intra-neural equations of state or anything else, it's going to be difficult to measure. I'm not going to lie. And it's because for the systems we expect to detect, now, the binary black hole case would be nice, because if these binary black holes, which are simpler, exist, and then you can actually see GR effects purely without matter, which would actually be useful because then they don't get entangled, right? You don't have matter effects going up the waveforms. So if binary black holes exist, then it's actually maybe a lot easier. Like if we have a 50-50 solar mass black hole for some reason exists, and we see it, there's something to be looking at. But if it's something, we're probably more going to be looking at things involving either small black holes or neutron stars. Effects of getting close together are going to be higher in those domains. So it would be as difficult to measure as any other There are things like Patrick said about the mass of the graviton and things like this that would actually cause dispersion in the gravitational wave propagation, stuff like that. There are people who have written papers about how that might show up.
Well, for that to be cosmological source for spiritual dispersion
is long enough.
It accumulates over the traveling distance. But the thought I had is that if you had a black hole, star binary, you have the possibility of the theories of emitting dipole radiation. I think that's something that would be revealed pretty well in the spiral. And it would be a pretty clear sign.
Dipole gravitational.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So that's something that would occur in, red sea type.
Right.
Can these detectors measure dipole radiation?
Well, they would measure all the radiation, but they would see that the spiral doesn't proceed as if it were only particle radiation. So it would be a faster spiral than would have been expected, and the frequency dependence would be different, so that it's not just a matter of adjusting parameters. So there would be a very different frequency dependence on the spiral rate.
We were actually discussing this the other day in the office. How much is that constrained already by binary pulsars? I don't have any sense.
I'm not an expert, but what I recall from reading papers on this is that if you have two neutron stars, and especially if they have very similar masses, even in Brzezinski type theories, they don't produce any dipole radiation because the two objects are too similar. So you really need to have something like a neutron star and a black hole that are very different to generate a significant mass dipole in your system.
And it's sufficiently good that you could explain it away by saying, okay, it wasn't a black hole of mass. 600 mass and a neutron star, but it was an HR mass black hole and a neutron star.
Well, I think it remains to be seen how well you can do this, but I think what gives you a chance is that, by changing parameters, you would modify coefficients in front of NF to the 2/3 type. In the rate of frequency change.
Right. Okay.
Whereas what you're talking about here is a new term that would go like 1/3. Of course, if your frequency range is not so large, you wouldn't tell the difference, but if you have favorable circumstances.
Okay.
So to what extent has been talked about in the literature, but...
Well, there's a work by Nico in France, and I think...
Well, doing...
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I think those are good questions to ask. France puts it nicely in the word. Biasing everything by saying GR is the ultimate theory, of course. We're there to discover whether it is or not. I think to come up with test type questions.
Any else? Thank you.
Before we thank Chad again, let me just make some announcements. So next week, David Garfinkel is visiting. He'll give a talk in the Cosmo. So Tom is scheduling that. That's Thursday morning.
In the what? He's planning to give a talk where?
There's a Cosmo series.
Oh, yeah. Cosmo
group, but it's a Thursday morning. And the afternoon at the 1:40 slot, we have the black hole reading group. Then the following week, there is a meeting going on. A bunch of people from CETA and from the US are coming. And within that, at the 1:40 slot, Steve Lindling is giving a talk overviewing the status of what happened with Krieger phenomenon. And then the following week on the 26th, Misha is giving a talk on this effective field theory point of view to calculate the orbits and video.
You're working on it? Yeah.
So a bunch of us might just hang around for a while, just continue talk, a group meeting that we didn't have on Tuesday, to continue something I didn't start, it's not the right way of putting it, but to have it. But let's thank chatting and stuff.
Thank you.